House come to order if members can take their seats.
This budget is a huge job maker, and the number one solution to economic insecurity is a job.
Hungry children can't learn, and it's our responsibility to try to help.
Equality and opportunity.
I believe most people are here because they want to do some good.
Thanks for opening this brand new episode of Capital Ideas. For the uninitiated, this is the one podcast in the whole cyber world where members of the Majority Democratic Caucus in the Washington State House of Representatives sit down at the Capitol and talk about ideas. The Democratic lawmaker you'll be hearing today is Representative Dave Paul. Dave lives in Oak Harbor in Washington's 10th Legislative District, and he's currently wrapping up session number 8 here in Olympia. Outside the Capitol, he's been a college professor and administrator for a quarter century, and he's currently director of community relations at Skagit Valley College. With that professional background, it's easy to see why his colleagues in the House chose him to chair the Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Committee. He's former vice chair of the House Transportation Committee, where he still has a seat, and he serves on the Technology, Economic Development, and Veterans Committee as well. In addition to those committee assignments, Dave is co-chair of the legislature's Ferry Caucus. That's enough bio for now, so let's get to our conversation. We recorded this on Monday, February 23rd, 2026, and you'll hear it now. Welcome to Capital Ideas, Representative Dave Paul from the 10th Legislative District.
So good to see you, Dan. Thank you for having me.
It's been 5 years since the last time you were a guest on Capital Ideas. We talked twice in your first 2 years, and now there's been this too large of a gap. So let's play catch up a little bit.
That sounds great.
We've got about 16, 17 days left in this legislative session. What's your frame of mind right now?
It's been a tough session because the state is facing some significant budget shortfalls, and I'm chair of the Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Committee, the House Higher Ed Committee, and the higher ed is not constitutionally protected in our state, so we're trying our best to protect that budget and making sure that all Washingtonians have access to great college and workforce training programs. So that's taken up a lot of my attention, much less on the policy side this session and much more on the budget side and trying to protect that for Washingtonians. We've got our supplemental operating budget that includes the Workforce Investment Act dollars that were first passed in 2019. There were some budget maneuvers done last year that folks in higher education aren't thrilled about. And so some of those dollars are being used. It's kind of complicated, but they're being used to supplant earlier dollars that were already assigned to higher education. The higher ed advocates aren't happy about that. We're trying to do our best. We know it's a tough budget environment, and we're just trying to do our best to be good team players, but we're also trying to protect valuable programs for Washingtonians.
I guess explaining to people that that's just the way it is doesn't really cut it, does it?
No, it's challenging. I mean, you've got your business organizations that help support the Workforce Investment Act when that was passed, and they're crabby to see those dollars go to other programs now. It is a balancing act. We're also trying to, in our state budget, protect access to quality childcare, and HR 1 out of Washington, D.C. really hurt Washington in terms of health care. And one of the priorities of our state budget process this year is trying to help Washingtonians that need that critical access to health care. So I get that there are really challenging competing demands here, and it's hard to develop that budget when state revenues aren't keeping up with demands on state services.
A few highlights for higher education. I know there were some lowlights as well, some things that won't make people happy, but there was a little bit of additional money that came the way of our higher education institutions.
There's a couple of things we can talk about in that budget. More Washingtonians are using the Washington College Grant, and that's really a good thing. So the budget increases that spending by $200 million, and that's terrific. We want more Washingtonians to fill out their FAFSA, that's the federal financial aid form, and get access to those state dollars. So again, we're spending $200 million more than we were expecting on that. Evergreen State College got an additional cut last year. We've helped restore that cut. Their enrollment is up for the third straight year. So I'm really pleased to see that. And we want to make sure that we're supporting that institution. And then in the state community technical college system. The budget fully funds the collective bargaining agreement that was struck late last year after we'd already written the budget and weren't able to get that in that last year's budget. But so it funds that collective bargaining agreement for our staff that work at our community technical colleges.
So that's not for faculty, that's for staff, is that correct?
That's for staff.
I think we'll circle back to the budget soon, but in the meantime, let's jump over to another budget, which is transportation.
Sure.
That's a committee that you have been a member of, I believe, since your first election.
Yeah.
And it's key to your district because it funds bridges and highways and infrastructure, but also ferries.
Yeah.
I think there was some good news about ferries in this budget, which, of course, is not the final budget. That's still to be determined, but it was a good bipartisan presentation.
Yeah, so the transportation and capital budgets are very bipartisan budgets, and I've been part of that transportation budget team. I was a vice chair for 2 years, and then the chair has allowed me to participate in the budget team for the ferries budget as well. The budget funds the third boat that the governor's proposed that we move up that funding to try to get that on the water faster. The governor proposed building three additional boats, boats 4, 5, and 6. We do not fund that, but we do have a plan in place to pull together the House, the Senate, ferries, the governor's office to look at what is the best path forward for that 4th, 5th, and 6th vessel. Because those are really critical, we get that plan in place ahead of the next legislative session so that we have those on the water about the time that you start seeing a whole bunch of our ferries that need to age out in 2035. It's critical that we have that plan in place. And then I think there's $2 million additional dollars to help with the maintenance and preservation of ferries, create a rapid response team so that when a ferry runs over a log, which happens on a regular basis, unfortunately, and bends a propeller, they can fix that very quickly. And then that team is assigned to the regular maintenance and preservation of ships when they're on dry dock. So this is a really important additional step to help keep ferries running and then to help augment the preservation work ferries is already doing in Eagle Harbor and elsewhere.
Is there a central dry dock area for these ferries, or are they scattered around Puget Sound and related waterways?
There are, I believe, three dry docks that are capable of handling Washington State ferries. The budget includes a study to look at maybe we should partner with a public-private partnership and look at securing a fourth dry dock that we would share with a shipbuilder or another entity. We spend enough on dry dock space that that might be cost effective. So we're going to be looking at that in the interim and seeing if that is something we want to be working with Washington State Ferries on. Yeah, there's a lot of demand out there for dry dock space. This could be good for both private industry and for Washington State Ferries.
I'll make a jump here and say that a lot of tourists might use those ferries. And speaking of tourists, take it away, Dave.
Yeah, so we just today passed House Bill 2325, that sets up an ability for the tourism and hospitality industry to assess itself and create a national and international marketing plan for bringing tourists to Washington State. And the timing of this could not be better. You know, we had the Seahawks win the Super Bowl and the Mariners go deep into the playoffs. We've got FIFA coming. A lot of folks around the world are watching Washington State. We ought to be using that opportunity to market our state and bring in tourists to all corners of our state and to do so in a responsible manner. We know we'll have lots of folks here for FIFA this summer. We want folks to stay and to visit all corners of the state and not just the Seattle area. This will allow us to better compete with our neighbors. So our neighboring states are spending tens of millions of dollars on pulling in international tourists and national tourists, tourists from across the country and the world. We spent virtually nothing on that effort. And all that was cut during the Great Recession. So this is a great opportunity for the tourist industry to build that program, to assess itself, so no state tax dollars will be used. Really excited and honored to be able to work on this policy and excited to get it passed by the Senate and to the governor's desk.
Congratulations on that victory.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So that bill just passed today, and day before yesterday, you had a town hall up in your 10th district, and one of the things that I think is unusual about that town hall is that you shared the stage with the Republican senator from the 10th district. So this was a truly bipartisan affair. this is not the normal way that lawmakers do these things, and I want to hear all about it.
Yeah, we had our mid-session town hall, and Senator Mizzal and I usually do a couple of town halls a session together, usually one at the beginning and one at the end of the session. We're one of only three districts in the state that's represented by both Democrats and Republicans, and it's a true swing district, and Ron and I are good friends. We can disagree on things policy-related, but at the end of the day, we're going to work together for our district. And it was a terrific event. We had 120 or so folks at the event. We had a town hall last year that we probably had 150 people trying to get into a room of 80. So we got a bigger venue this year, and a wide range of questions, you know, about ferries, about taxes, about immigration customs enforcement, and the impacts of federal policies on our state. Terrific to see everybody. And folks, I think we're really pleased that Ron and I are willing to do that together and answer those questions and serve the district.
What did you hear most from your constituents, if it's possible to put your finger on an issue or two?
Yeah. So I think folks are really unhappy about what's happening at the national level. And folks in our district just don't like the partisan politics you see at the national level. They want people to work together. Folks are very concerned about immigration and customs enforcement. We've met with middle school kids that are scared that they're going to have neighbors or family members deported. I've spoken more and more strongly about how I think the actions of ICE and the federal government are really unconstitutional and un-American. And when we look at the Bill of Rights and what the Bill of Rights is trying to protect for Americans, the idea that ICE agents could sign their own warrants to break into somebody's house to try to detain somebody, fundamentally, that's un-American. We always have had a judge, a neutral party say, yeah, that's enough evidence to go, you know, essentially break into somebody's house and arrest them. Folks are really upset about that. And so we talked about that, and we may not be able at the state level to force ICE agents to be unmasked. But we talked about that at the town hall, that that is so bad for our local law enforcement agencies, that as you see people's anger over what's happening at the national level, that can trickle down and impact our great local law enforcement and state agencies that are trying to do the right thing in their communities. You know, Washington State's had this long history of de-escalation. When we're training police officers, we're training them how to de-escalate situations. And that predates me being in the legislature. That was initiated with the Citizens Initiative in 2018. So what we're seeing at the federal level just flies in the face of that. It's, again, I keep coming back to this, it's fundamentally un-American what's going on, and we're going to try to do what we can at the state level to stop that, recognizing that that unbalanced power dynamic between the federal government and the state government.
One of the things that has characterized this legislative session is an awareness all the way around that there's been a problem with revenue. There are some people who say, well, here's the reason and here's the solution. There are other people that have other opinions about it. But the fact is, we work with a revenue system that was designed, I don't know, sometime in the beginning of the Great Depression. And it doesn't seem to work for anybody now, particularly lower and middle income people who pay through the nose compared to their more well-off counterparts. What's your take on what's going on revenue-wise?
It's really challenging right now. So, you know, we've got the second most regressive tax system in the country. So we've made some minor progress. I mean, it was the most regressive tax system in the country when I was elected. Now we're second. Working Washingtonians pay much more in taxes than wealthier Washingtonians as a percentage of their income. So a lot of focus this year on the so-called millionaire's tax. I don't think that's a great name for it. The idea of taxing for folks who earn over $1 million, that first million would not be taxed, but after that could be taxed at, I think the proposal is 9.9%. And I understand from a moral perspective why so many of my constituents think that that should be passed. I've also got some concerns, so I'm officially in that undecided category about what to do, how I'm going to vote on the tax. I am concerned about our state budget process, and we have had a number of problems over the years trying to balance our state budget as expenses have exceeded what we're bringing in. And the longer I do this, the more I learn about how we don't account in the budget process for cost of living increases for state employees beyond that first, the biennium that we're budgeting in right then and there. We do that in K-12, but we don't do that for higher education or other state agencies. And that, to me, creates some problems because as we're constitutionally obligated to create a four-year balanced budget, we're not taking into account what we would expect to see in years 3 and 4 of that. Because those employees, I think, rightfully are going to want that cost of living increase. We've got a better budget for that and create guardrails so that if the tax is passed, if the proposal is passed, how are we making sure that that doesn't creep down to folks that earn less than $1 million a year? I think that's a legitimate concern. And what can we do to help make sure that we're not going to get down to an income tax that's taxing everyday Washingtonians? We've got to have some sort of comprehensive tax reform overall that's going to reduce the sales tax, reduce property taxes, reduce the B&O tax. I really understand the both sides of this argument. And because of that, I have not decided how I'm going to vote. And that's part of the point of the town hall was to get to talk to folks. And I'm going to spend the rest of the session talking to folks in the district and finding out their opinions on the subject.
Sounds like a pretty sane way to approach this.
I appreciate that, Dan.
Let's talk about one more committee. This one has a pretty good tie-in to your district because there are a lot of people in uniform in your district and a lot of people who used to wear the uniform. You're a member of the Technology, Economic Development, and, importantly, Veterans Committee. How would you describe the work of that committee during the 2026 session?
We have focused a lot on emergency preparedness, and we had flooding up in our district that was very significant. And thankfully, most of the work we had done in previous years to help prepare for that really paid off. So the flood mitigation wall in Mount Vernon, that held strong and prevented flooding in our downtown area in Mount Vernon. Yeah, we focus a lot on veterans, and you're right. We've got a higher percentage of veterans in Island County than any other county in the state. A really high percentage across the 10th district. We're looking at ways of helping to support veterans across our state and also military families. Some of that work is also bleeds into the post-secondary education committee. As we look at ways of joining compacts, those are licensing compacts that allow folks that might get their professional license in one state to then automatically get that in Washington state. That's incredibly helpful for military spouses that move around a lot. And also in the other committee, in the post-secondary education committee, we looked at a bill to help out the children of 100% disabled veterans. That did not make it out of the House, and there was a version in the Senate that didn't make it out of the Senate this year because of budget reasons, but we'll be coming back and looking at that. But in the Technology and Economic Development and Veterans Committee, we'll continue to look at ways of helping to support veterans as they transition into civilian life, and then making sure that they've got the support from our state to live happy and healthy lives after their service to our country.
I've had you here for as long as your schedule has you here. Any parting words, Dave?
Well, I really appreciate everybody who writes and visits us here in Olympia to give us feedback on bills and priorities. You know, we spend the interim working on policies that maybe we started this year that we're going to fine-tune. And I had a bill to help folks that were sadly killed in the line of service, either firefighters or law enforcement officials, to help their surviving spouses. You know, that bill did not get to the finish line here, but we'll continue to work on that and other policies to get feedback from stakeholders and figure out the right way of moving forward on those in the interim. Also an opportunity to get out and about the community and hear what's most important for you headed into the 27th session.
I appreciate you coming by. I once again apologize for the time that's elapsed since our last visit, but here is my pledge to you. It won't be 5 more years, Dave.
Well, I look forward to talking with you next session.
Good. All right. Hold me to it.
I will.
I appreciate you coming by. Thanks, Representative Dave Paul from District Number 10, up in the northwest corner of Washington State. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Dan. We'll see you soon.
Well, now you've got a good idea of who Dave Paul is and why his friends and neighbors in the 10th Legislative District are fortunate to have him on the job. We upload Capital Ideas a couple of times a week during the legislative session, and if you subscribe, those new conversations will show up on your phone, tablet, or computer as if by magic. This is your state government, and what happens here matters more today than ever before. I'm Dan Frizzell for the Washington State House Democrats, putting people first since 1889, the year Susan LaFleche Picot, a member of the Omaha tribe, became the first Native American woman to graduate from medical school in these United States. Thanks for your time.